A few decades ago, war was legal and considered the ultimate arbiter of disputes between nations. Well, that all changed after World War II. Since then, nations that wage aggressive war have become outcasts and have almost always had to jettison their territorial gains. How did this huge transformation come about? Well, my next guest traces the change to the widely derided Kellogg-Briand Peace Pact in Paris from 1928. To tell us more about all this, let's hear from Una Hathaway. She's Professor of Law at Yale University and co-author of The Internationalists, How a Radical Plan to Outlaw War Remade the World. Una, welcome to RN.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Now, tell us briefly about the story of the Internationalists that you and your colleague, Scott Shapiro, uncover.
Well, we argue that the world used to look very different from the way it looks today. War used to be perfectly legal and legitimate. States could wage war to right wrongs, and that was considered perfectly fine. And because war was legal, conquest was legal, gunboat diplomacy was accepted. Those who waged aggressive war weren't doing anything wrong, so they couldn't be criminally prosecuted. And strangely enough, economic sanctions were illegal. And the argument is that that all changed in 1928, thanks to this much maligned Kellogg-Briand Pact, which we also thought was kind of an absurd agreement. We started out this project thinking what everyone else did about the Kellogg-Briand Pact, which is that it was an utter failure. And what we discovered is actually it played a really important role in the transformation of the system and really is the reason that we have the world order we have today.
So your line then is that although the pact may not have ended all war, it was highly effective in ending the main reason countries have gone to war, and that's conquest.
Yes. So it changed the rules. And because it changed the rules, it said that war is no longer a legal way to resolve disputes, that states that are wronged can't use war to right those wrongs. And they can't use war to seize territory from other states. They can't change the legal rights to territory through use of military force. And you can actually see a real change in the world. We did a study of every territorial transfer from 1816 to the present to see, did this actually change anything on the ground? Did something actually change in the real world? And the answer is actually something really important did change, that conquest used to be incredibly common. The average state could expect to suffer a conquest roughly once in a human lifetime before 1928. Today, the frequency is closer to once or twice in a millennium. So that's a big change. And at least in part, that's due to the Kellogg-Briand Pact.
Well, let's test your thesis, because we all too often talk about this post-World War II rules-based international order with the United Nations as its guardian, if you like. What about the Soviet expansion into Eastern Europe, the Iron Curtain in the wake of World War II? Doesn't that challenge your thesis?
Yeah, so it's a really interesting phenomenon that the Soviets, who were, of course, major participants all along in the 1928 agreement and then its reaffirmation in the United Nations Charter, it was really Stalin, Roosevelt, and Churchill who negotiated the kind of finishing touches on the UN Charter at Yalta. And then the Soviets, you know, really do push to expand communism throughout Eastern Europe. What's interesting is that they do that primarily, not exclusively, but primarily through providing support for communist governments and through trying to subvert democratically elected governments, not, with a few exceptions, through using military force, which would have been the old way of doing things, right? The old way of doing things would have been send in your military, send in your army, take over the government, take over the territory. There's very little of that. Of course, there was the response to the civil war in Hungary, the coup in Hungary, where the Soviets went in and occupied. But with rare exceptions, they mostly did it through support for communist governments and communist groups within the Eastern Bloc. And I think that that is a change, and it's an important change.
What about Putin's annexation of Ukraine's Crimean Peninsula 3-4 years ago?
Yeah, that's a really important one. And you know, we talk a lot about that in the book. And we think it's a real warning sign. It's a real warning sign that Russia is willing to flaunt the most central rule of the international legal system. It's the first act of outright conquest in the post-UN world in Europe. And, you know, the world has reacted with really significant approbation and, you know, has really decried the Putin's seizure of Crimea. There's been significant economic sanctions put in place both by the United States and European Union. So it isn't like he's gotten off scot-free, and very few recognize Crimea as part of Russia today. But it is a real warning sign, and it's one we have to take very seriously, and the world needs to really continue to resist that.
Yeah, well, there's no question, as you make it quite clear in your thesis, we've witnessed the large decrease in the number of interstate conflict, notwithstanding Putin's annexation of Crimea. But what about the rise of intrastate conflict or civil wars? I mean, it's now coming to an end, but this civil war in Syria could cost hundreds of thousands of lives. I mean, how would you respond to that?
Yeah, and we actually have a whole chapter in the book about this, which is called "Why Is There Still So Much Conflict?" And which shows, in fact, that even as you have a really rapid decline in wars between states, you have a rise in the number of failed states and a rise in civil wars or intrastate wars. And we think those are not unrelated, and this is, in a sense, a kind of unintended consequence of the success of the international legal order in keeping states from going to war with one another. It's that weak states continue to survive and that they become failed states and they collapse under the weight of civil war. And, you know, that suggests that one thing that the international legal order, the international community ought to do is to try to prop up states that need support, that need more effective policing, that need more effective state institutions, that's in this world where you can't go to war against a state and where states can't intervene in other states that are failing without their permission, you do need to try to find ways to help those state systems continue to be successful.
Okay, so back to your thesis here. I mean, your argument then is that Kellogg brand changed state behavior. But see, your critics will say that there are other contributing factors to the decline of war and the end of conquest in recent decades. You think of free trade, the decline of racism, which sometimes helped justify colonial conquest. As a realist, I would argue the role of nuclear deterrence. I mean, if you go back to the subcontinent, the Asian subcontinent, India and Pakistan, from 47, from partition, to the early 70s, UNA, India and Pakistan fought three conventional land wars. But since these two countries developed nuclear technology and programs and bombs, they haven't fought a land war, really. So can't nuclear deterrence account for the stability and the relative peace of this international rules-based order?
Well, so nuclear weapons wouldn't suggest they're not unimportant, and we talk a bit about them in the book, and they are part of what has helped keep the peace. They're not a sufficient explanation for the peace. Of course, you know, when the United States was the only one with nuclear weapons, it didn't use it to conquer the rest of the world. It didn't use it to seize significant amounts of territory. That states that are non-nuclear states don't go to war with one another and seize one another's territory. Our argument is that nuclear weapons are used largely to keep the peace, in part because they're used to enforce the rules of the international legal order. And the rules of the international legal order are states can't use military force against one another. Mm. So nuclear weapons are used to enforce the rules. But what are the rules? The rules are the rules that they are because of this change in the legal order in 1928 and reaffirmed in 45.
My guest is Una Hathaway. She's professor of law at Yale University and co-author of The Internationalists, How a Radical Plan to Outlaw War Remade the World. Keeping with nuclear weapons here, the 2017 Nobel Prize for Peace was awarded to the Australian-founded anti-nuclear weapons group. This is ICAN. Let's listen to the news.
A moment of triumph, a grassroots movement trying to change the world. The International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, or ICAN, receives the Nobel Peace Prize in Norway. The group, recognised for helping create the first ever international treaty to ban nuclear weapons, was adopted by 122 countries, none of them nuclear powers, at the United Nations in July. Australia is not one of them.
Now, in recent months, we've had the United Nations follow this group's advice, and they've signed a treaty in 2017 to ban nuclear weapons. Now, your realist critics, Una, would say that its ambition is matched only by that of Kellogg Briand. How would you respond to that?
Well, I think that what's interesting here is that the treaty, and I admire those who are working hard for it and their ambition, but so far it has very few states on board. And that's a real difference with the Kellogg-Brand Pact. So this treaty, last I checked, had somewhere around 56 states signing it, only three had ratified it. The Kellogg-Brand Pact, by contrast, was ratified by nearly every country in the world within a year of it being introduced. It was the most ratified treaty in the world at the time. So I don't think you can compare them. When you get when this treaty gets to 190 member states, then we can have the conversation. Then we'll say, okay, they're pretty similar. But until then, they're pretty different.
Yeah, but I mean, a leading realist, Walter Lippmann, he observed in 1943, when the illusions of disarmament had been revealed by the World War, he said famously that the disarmament movement of the 20s and 30s is basically having a go here at Kellogg-Briand. It was, quote, tragically successful in disarming the nations that believed in disarmament. So is there a danger here that when groups, whether it's Kellogg-Briand or the United Nations Disarmament Committee groups, when they disarm or support disarmament, you're not going to stop the Kim Jong-uns from developing their own nuclear weapons?
Well, I think this is part of the reason that it's going to be very hard for this treaty to succeed, although, again, I applaud the effort. I think, you know, as long as the nuclear states don't sign, and I don't see any likelihood that they are going to sign, you are unlikely to see the treaty succeed. By contrast, again, the Kellogg-Briand Pact, every major state signed it. So that was just a very different picture. The United States signed it, Germany, Japan, you know, the United Kingdom, France, all the major states had ratified the treaty. And so it became the law for all of those states, and they understand that those are the rules of the game going forward.
Mm. Let's conclude with this rules-based liberal international order. We all too often hear about it. It's being lionized, particularly in the Trump era. But it is being seriously challenged, and not just by the US president. There's a populist backlash in many parts of Europe, certainly in America, against free trade, globalization. I mentioned North Korea, this rogue state regularly flouts international rules and norms with its nuclear tests. We mentioned Russia, its invaded Crimea. We haven't mentioned China, flouting the Hague's ruling against Beijing's conduct in the South China Sea. Some might point to the US-led invasion of Iraq in 2003. I suppose the question here, Una, is are we witnessing the end or fragmentation of this post-World War II system that Kellogg-Briand helped create?
Well, this is one of the reasons we wrote the book, and we end by talking about exactly this. You know, we've had 7 decades of unprecedented international peace. We've seen a major decline of interstate war. We've not seen a single war between the great powers. We have had unprecedented level of peace and prosperity the world over, although, of course, there have been, this is not to suggest that there haven't been wars that have broken out that have been devastating, but if you compare them historically, it has been a much more peaceful period than ever before in human history. And that is all at risk. We are at a very dangerous moment in history where states are beginning to wonder whether the system is going to work. Russia has shown itself willing to flout the rules. And the United States seems to be backing off of its support for the international legal order, threatening to withdraw from the WTO, withdrawing some support from the UN, you know, putting more money into the military and less into diplomacy. And that's very dangerous. And what we want to argue for in the book is recognize what we have, recognize how valuable it is, don't take it for granted, and this is something well worth defending and fighting for, because it is, you know, much of what we take for granted today has given us peace and prosperity that we should not be assuming will last forever.
Well, the distinguished historian Margaret McMillan says your book is, quote, fascinating and challenging, and it raises gravely important issues for the present. Congratulations, Una, and thanks so much for being on the program.
Thanks so much for having me.